It is Thursday, March 3rd, 2022. My name is Emma Vigeland in for Sam Cedar, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Alex Salmon, writer at the American Prospect, joins us to discuss his piece in the New Republic on IKEA and their role in the deforestation of Europe. Meanwhile, the UN says that at least 1 million people have fled Ukraine and millions more have fled their homes to seek shelter in Western Ukraine. Thankfully, the EU is expected to give blanket protection to all who fled. Russian forces have seized the southern Ukrainian port city of Kherson, a city with a population of nearly 300,000. It is the first major city to fall in the war. Biden has asked Congress to approve $10 billion in relief for Ukraine, in addition to the White House imposing technology export bans to both Russia and Belarus. Manchin has some new demands. If he is to release the hostage that is Build Back Better, they include more domestic oil production, tax reform and prescription drug prices. Lots of wiggle room in those last two, but the first is a disaster. In Texas, a judge has blocked the state from investigating the parents of a trans kid over gender-affirming care, but left the door open for these kinds of investigations in the future. More on that in a bit. The January 6th committee says it sees evidence of a, quote, criminal conspiracy between Trump and his allies to overturn the election. And lastly, employees of Recreation Equipment Incorporated, REI, have voted overwhelmingly to unionize in New York City. This could have ripple effects across the country as the company has 15,000 employees nationwide. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. Here I am with you solo. Matt has started the first week of his vacation, so usually he kind of fills in some of the gaps in my thinking. I rely on him a lot to speak a bit more when I'm hosting by myself. So we'll see how this goes. And we got Bradley doing two jobs over here. So, you know, we're just the two of us today, but later in the fun half, of course, we will be joined by Brandon Sutton and Matt Binder to talk about some funny clips, the fun half. That's what that's for. But first, let's talk a little bit about two things. One, I want to touch on the Texas anti-trans movement from the Republicans there. But first, I want to highlight, you know, I saw some tweet from some pundit that all of the Russian people are complicit in what's happening in Ukraine. They're just all complicit, which is an insane thing to say. I mean, it's the way that the United States justified its war on terror and the violence that it rained down upon Afghanistan, Iraq, and the other countries that we continued to drone strike, for example. But there are differing reports. Watchdog groups have said thus far that around 8,000 people have been arrested in Russia in anti-war demonstrations. Now, we're about to show you a clip of an elderly woman being arrested here. I mean, honestly, I watched this yesterday and it moved me to tears. Her name is Yelena Osipova. She was at an anti-war demonstration in St. Petersburg. She is a survivor of the siege of Leningrad, which, for people that don't know, was a when the German forces went to the USSR, Leningrad's now St. Petersburg. That's what they think they call the 900-day siege. But a million of the city's civilians and soldiers died during that time. Yelena Osipova survived, and here she is demonstrating in St. Petersburg in that city and getting arrested for the cause of speaking out against Russia's invasion and war in Ukraine. Differing reports about, is there no sound on this? That's all right. We're still working through it. I should clarify that there, it's hard to fully know if she was born before or after. I'm not exactly sure if the reports have been clear on this. Apologies, but, Let's just play the video one more time if we can get the sound. Again, just bear with us. Differing reports about, is there no sound on this? That's all right. I should clarify that there, it's hard to fully know if she was born before or after. I'm not exactly sure if the reports have been clear on this. Apologies one more time if we can get the sound. Again, just bear with us. Differing reports about, is there no sound on this? That's all right. I should clarify that there, it's hard to fully know if she was born before or after. I'm not exactly sure
survived
if the reports have been clear on this. Apologies.
The war
one more time
and was
if
in
get the sound.
St. Petersburg
again,
then
just
Leningrad
bear with
as
us.
A baby.
She's a part of the mass demonstrations here. And I just want to emphasize that this takes immense courage.
Reports about
Putin and his government have
no
been
sound on this?
Clear that they're
sorry.
Going to crack down on protesters and have sent a chilling effect throughout the country.
I should clarify that
about
they're
speaking out publicly about this.
It's hard to
there's nothing I think purer than and
before,
more
after,
morally righteous
I'm not exactly-
than anti-war activism because it comes from such a visceral and emotional place and. The concern for people who aren't you or people who aren't in your immediate family, that is what the heart of anti-war activism is. A lot of the Justice Democrats and the squad say, I'm going to butcher the quote, but I care about someone who I don't know. Right, that's going to be the heart of their politics. That's what
and
they
war after,
and that
right.
really
not
is
exactly
the kernel and the core of anti-war activism. And you're going up against a military-industrial complex, a state that is and a head of state that's immensely invested in bloodshed and imperialism, and you're showing immense bravery. So to me, seeing Yelena Osipova get arrested there. It's just a reminder that human beings are not always complicit in the actions of their government, and punishing regular citizens for the actions of their government is immoral. And that's why sanctions have to be very thin, very targeted, very much so. And some of the Russian citizenry is already feeling the effects of the sanctions that have been imposed. It's a difficult line to walk. I understand that. But there's just a reminder that there are millions and millions of Russians who are opposed to this. And they're showing bravery just as the Ukrainians are in opposing Russian imperialism. But I wanted to, here, let me grab, highlight this too before we get to Alex Salmon. So, here it is. So, the ACLU has taken up a case, and they were partially successful yesterday when a Texas judge blocked Texas, the state, from investigating the parents of a trans teenager because their parents were engaging in and supporting their child and engaging in gender-affirming care. But the judge did not make a sweeping assessment over whether or not the state should stop investigating parents for participating in gender-affirming care for their kids. Now, this comes on the heels of Ken Paxton, who basically just issued a press release, legal opinion, that called gender-affirming care child abuse. Then Greg Abbott, whose primary was coming up, it's now passed, he won easily, issued a directive and said perhaps there should be an investigation into parents who engage in gender-affirming care for their children. The ACLU then followed up, decided to represent a particular family. There was a victory for that individual family, but the threat of these kinds of investigations in Texas remain. And I wanted to highlight this amazing piece by Sanaa Day, I hope I didn't butcher that, and Karen Brooks Harper in the Texas Tribune that came out earlier this week, because they interviewed a child, a trans child, and their family, who is they're fearful of what this investigation may hold. And it's really excellent reporting that takes me all the way over there. Sorry. Jeez. Crying on 12:15 in the morning. Adeline, who stands at 5'5" and is outspoken in class, had been having panic attacks in school as she approached puberty. Will you put the article back up? Yeah, right. If not, that's okay. After she started seeing the doctors in North Dallas, the attacks stopped. But last week, the panic attack started again when Republican Governor Greg Abbott, 7 days before the GOP primary election, in which he's being accused of not being conservative enough, ordered state child welfare officials to launch child abuse investigations into reports of transgender kids receiving gender-affirming care. Adeline is terrified that she will be forcibly separated from her mother. So great is her anxiety that she doesn't want to sleep in her own bed. The Vigil family agreed to speak with the Texas Tribune, but did not feel safe disclosing the details about Adeline's medical care. A recent study showed that more than 40% of transgender youth attempt suicide. The rate of suicide attempts among transgender youth is 3 times higher than among their cisgender counterparts, according to a recent study by the U.S. Centers for by the CDC. So she's not alone. The piece continues to highlight other kids, but another quote from this that rung in my ears. Since Adeline's mother sat her down and told her about the governor's order, the teen has been reconsidering whether she wants to go to her next doctor's appointment. She has been scrolling through TikTok videos about The Order until her mother comes home from work. On Thursday, she tried to watch a Percy Jackson movie as a distraction, but the fear was getting to her. When I'm at work, she keeps calling and calling. When are you going to be home and how long? How much longer are you almost home? Adamala said. It affects her in the sense that she wants to feel that kind of security and feel safe around me. I mean, that's the point here, too, is when there's an understanding that being yourself and your parents helping you be yourself could get your parents in trouble with the law. In addition to just the general trauma of having to grow up trans in a state that hates you and actively codifies that into law, and it's, they're open about it for their electoral reasons, for Greg Abbott to, he wants to get through a primary, right? There's trauma growing up trans, and then there's the additional trauma of feeling like being yourself is going to get your parents locked up, and the fact that they're helping you be yourself is going to get your parents locked up, let alone the cost for the family, the fact that they have to drive hours and hours to receive this kind of care. The effects of what Abbott and his administration is trying to do, I mean, that's going to have a chilling effect also on care available, let alone the trauma inflicted on trans kids in this massive state of Texas. There are thousands and thousands of kids that are going to be affected by this. Even if it's found to be, it's deemed to be unconstitutional, even if it gets to, like, say, the Supreme Court or something. And, you know, the best case scenario is that Abbott used this as a tactic because he had a primary election coming up and he doesn't follow through on this. But, you know, expecting the best of Republicans is not the way to go. So we'll see where this goes. But I mean, putting a human face to this and hearing how a child feels and what gender affirming care does for that child. They are stripped of their voices in this conversation. Children are human beings and they deserve validation and they deserve their emotions to be heard and understood just like adults are. They feel things, and belittling them and blocking them from being themselves on the statewide level, I mean, that speaks way more to the kind of person that these Republicans are than anything else. So, all right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we are going to be joined by Alex Salmon to talk about deforestation in Europe. Be right back. We'll be right back. is what we're going to be talking a bit about today. Alex, thank you so much for being with us today. Really appreciate it.
Hey, yeah, thanks for having me.
So this piece is a wild ride. I mean, honestly, I'd encourage everybody to check it out. It's called IKEA's Race for the Last of Europe's Old Growth Forests. It just takes a bunch of twists and turns. And the fact that you were really in harm's way personally is just another, I'm glad you're okay based on the, like, the insane violence in this story. I mean, talk a little bit about how you even learned about this topic and why you chose to cover it on the ground despite the risks involved.
Yeah, it was something that I found out about a couple of years ago. I was reading in the BBC, there was this news hit about a forest ranger in Romania who'd gotten murdered and in conjunction with some illegal logging. And in the piece, they mentioned that he was the second forest ranger to be murdered in like a 6-week span, which seemed like a pretty, you know, shocking sort of episode of violence for a country that's, you know, obviously an EU member state. It's not the sort of place where you would expect that sort of thing to be happening generally. So I read that, started looking into it. You know, I kind of one thing led to led to another, as these things often do. And yeah, I found out, you know, first that IKEA is the largest private landowner in Romania, and that this, you know, illegal logging is happening on a massive scale, and kind of the pieces started falling together, and eventually decided to go out there and do some reporting on the ground.
So your piece opens with a terrifying story not involving you. Could you just take the audience through that? And I mean, I think that's a great conduit into the larger topics we'll be discussing.
Yeah, sure thing. So yeah, it starts out, there were two local documentarians, a director and a videographer, basically working on a project also about, you know, illegal logging in Romania, which is obviously a local concern as much as anything. And they've been shadowing this environmentalist named Tiberiu, who is well known in you know, parts of Romania. He's got a big Facebook following, and he, over the last 5 years, has done a lot of work rooting out illegal logging, confronting loggers, chasing down trucks full of contraband. And so they were shadowing him for 4 days as part of their shoot. And on the final day, they went to go investigate what they assumed was an illegal logging site. They got a tip that there was one. They went to check it out. And when they got there, they obviously found the stumps that they were looking for and called the forest, what they thought, I guess, was the forest ranger to come investigate. And they were greeted instead by two cars full of attackers, basically, like 15 men, wielding bats and axes, who jumped out and besieged them effectively. All three of them ended up in the hospital. Two of them were knocked out. They really, I think, attempted to kill Tiberiu, who has, you know, a reputation as an environmentalist in this region. And, it was just kind of horrifying attack. And it happened actually, I think, the day after I'd arrived in Romania. So I kind of knew that there were these risks involved. I kind of read about some of the previous attacks, and then obviously got very real very quickly, because, you know, right away there was this this major assault that resulted in all three of them being hospitalized.
Yeah, and that's not the only attack of that nature on environmentalists and journalists. I mean, you highlight them a little bit later. Can you talk about, like, the history a little bit of how frequent these attacks on people looking a little bit more into the illegal deforestation, how there is a history of that more than just, you know, the initial terrifying story that you talk about at the outset?
Yeah. I think the official tally, as I've seen it, is that there have been 6 murders in the last couple of years in relation to illegal logging, either forest rangers or environmentalists who've been killed. And then another 650 odd attacks of various sorts. So, you know, with bats or axes or guns or any sort of, you know, anything from a, you know, attempted murder to sort of hand to hand brawling. But, you know, those numbers are obviously probably very low. Those are just the official tallies. I think this sort of thing is almost day in, day out for people who are in this, you know, line of work. And, And it's obviously incredibly commonplace, and it's very dangerous for those who are involved.
So let's talk a little bit about Romania as the home to the Amazon of Europe, which is an apt way, as you write, to talk about it in more ways than one. One, based on its importance environmentally, and two, the way it's been rapidly deforested. Can you talk a little bit about the history there?
Yeah, it's a really interesting history, I think. And, you know, for various reasons, the industrialization of Europe even plays a big role in this. But Romania happens to have, more than half, some estimates would put it even closer to 70% of the remaining old growth forest left in Europe, you know, outside of Scandinavia. So this sort of temperate old growth forest. And, you know, Europe has been heavily deforested, obviously. I think it's less than 4% of European forest land remains intact. But Romania, for various reasons, it's far from industrial centers. It was a closed off communist state for a long time, has this incredible forest land in the Carpathian Mountains. And you know, it's exceptionally important for a lot of reasons, one of which is biodiversity. Obviously, old growth forests is super important for maintaining that biodiversity. It's an incredibly lush ecosystem. Also important for climate reasons. The carbon capture abilities of an old growth forest outstrip any other technology that we have to do that. So it's important for a lot of reasons. And now is obviously very much in the crosshairs of the global timber market and in the furniture industry in particular. And so since Romania joined the EU, basically this forest has been disappearing at an astonishing rate.
Right. So take us a little through that history back to the fall of the Soviet Union, which opened them up to privatization. I did not expect to see Harvard University and their endowment involved in this story. I mean, there are so many crazy intertwining actors in this. It just blew my mind, truly.
It is kind of a stranger than fiction story, but if you start from the beginning, when communism ends in 1989 in Romania, obviously all the forest land was publicly held at that point, and there's an attempt to reprivatize some of these land holdings. And obviously this is the story in so many of these post-communist states that that program was marred by corruption. It was insanely addled in every way by, backroom dealings and dubious actors. And because of that, a bunch of people end up buying up forest land who are, they're not Romanians. They're not even people who have any interest in forests as such. They're just people looking to make a quick buck. And one of those groups is the Harvard University Endowment, which is, one of the great institutional investors of our time. And they, not for nothing, many of the leaders of Harvard have also had close ties to the World Bank and the IMF and the organizations that cheered these sort of privatization schemes on. And they, they get tipped off effectively that there's a lot of land to be had on the cheap, and they start buying it up in 2004, they start buying up parcels, and quickly they become the largest private landowner in Romania, I think outside of the church at that point. And obviously this stuff is
now IKEA, right? So
yeah.
So first Harvard, the Harvard Endowment becomes the number one landowner in Romania. And now that's IKEA. So how much of that was transferred over to IKEA? How much of that was sold, I should say, to IKEA?
Oh yeah, a lot. I think an overwhelming percentage of it actually is. Harvard gets in a little bit of legal trouble for their acquisition, obviously. No surprise, a lot of these holdings were illegally acquired or done so in such dubious fashion that actually the businessman that they were working with on the deal got a 3-year suspended sentence because of that deal. And they were looking at some legal challenges, and rather than deal with them, they just decided to sell. And the buyer, the ready and willing buyer, was IKEA. So IKEA, I think, ended up buying something like 30,000 odd hectares from Harvard. And then they've compiled more and more forest land ever since. And I think they now own about 50,000 hectares, which puts them, far and away the number one private landowner in the country.
So, I mean, what makes the ancient forests like this, these particular forests, you touched on it a bit, but the fact that it's so effective, the old growth forest is the right term, for carbon capture, what makes this appealing to, say, IKEA in terms of, like, I don't know, why can't they just cut down some regular wood? I know that sounds stupid, but is it just they're because of deforestation globally, they're running out? I mean, what is the financial incentive for a major corporation like IKEA to target these really just important forests?
I think it's a couple of things. One, obviously, land is fairly cheap in Romania and labor is very cheap, especially for in the broader EU. So, you know, you can get your hands on these forests for a pretty favorable price, and you can pay people to get, you know, get the logs out of there for a pretty favorable price as well. The reality is IKEA is the largest wood consumer on the planet. It's the largest individual wood, I think, processor and retailer on Earth. There are estimates to say that they consume at least 1% of wood every year globally. They're growing by 2 million trees a year on average, maybe even more than that now. And so they have a huge appetite. I mean, the amount of wood that they consume is just astonishing. And so they have a major investment in Eastern Europe and Russia. That's, you know, really where their supply chain is located. And so it's not like they're seeking out old growth forests in particular, just they have such a demand for wood, and that's where they are. It just happens to be the place where, you know, this incredibly important old growth forest is also located.
So then I guess take us to Romania's admission into the EU. You know, the 1989 Soviet Union collapses, Romania is no longer a communist, moving towards like rapid privatization, and the neoliberal vultures are circling all of the former Soviet territories. I mean, there are parts of this that are Prussian and or not Prussian, but important for, say, what we're talking about with Ukraine. But we can keep that aside for a little bit. Then Romania gets admitted into the EU later, and the deforestation accelerates to a shocking degree. Take us through that period of history.
Sure. Yeah. And it kind of touches on one of the interesting, you know, one of the inherent contradictions at the heart of the EU, where, you know, the Romania goes in, I think exceeds in 2005. And these estimates are kind of rough because there's not great monitoring even, but from 2007 onward, between half and two thirds of virgin forest in Romania has been destroyed. So it's pretty much right on schedule with Romania's entry into the EU. And the reason is, of course, that, you know, joining the EU exists to facilitate, you know, global trade in a lot of ways. It's to expedite, you know, commerce in many senses. And of course, getting rid of these national boundaries made it much easier for a company like IKEA to operate, or, you know, even other, you know, there are other companies that are out there as well. There are huge Austrian mills, you know, timber processors who are out there, and they're able to set up shop very easily because there are no obstacles anymore to doing so. And the labor is so cheap, which makes it even more of an incentive for, you know, these companies based elsewhere in Europe to really hone in there. And, you know, that's the sort of economic reality of the EU. The flip side is that the EU also has, you know, made these climate and biodiversity commitments that are fairly substantial. And so now they desperately want to protect this forest because it's, you know, it plays a critical role in those pledges, and they're basically powerless to do so, or they're, you know, struggling to figure out what they can do to prevent this deforestation from becoming total.
Oh, yeah. It's interesting that you mention, like, some of, like, I don't know. This is such a shallow thought, but just based on how IKEA presented itself, I was like, this is an okay company. I mean, right? Like, they tout their environmental bona fides. They are, like, aesthetically Scandinavian, which maybe, like, it comes off as clean. I mean, look, I'm Swedish. And, I mean, I'm not Swedish. I'm Finnish and I'm Norwegian. I'm not Swedish. So, like, I guess aesthetically I'm into what that the way it presents itself. Again, this is such a shallow, like, thought that I've had, but they did market themselves as environmentally sustainable. What was fascinating in your piece was how they kind of get around that by using an NGO certification from the FSC, which has been fairly heavily criticized by, like, a more reputable Greenpeace organization. I mean, talk a little bit about how they present themselves in such a way, but aren't, when you scratch a little bit before below the surface, it's not the case.
He has a really good brand management strategy, and they tell a very compelling environmental story about their sustainability. You'll see those pledges all over the store. You can get a vegan hot dog when you go there. It's obviously very effective.
That's part of it too, right? It's like the yeah, exactly. Go on.
yeah. And they're good. Yeah, it's a great vegan hot dog. yeah, the sort of the sustainability pledge or the model that they put forward is all predicated on this FSC certification. That's basically what they use as a stand-in for sustainable. And you know, I think 98% or something of the manufacturers and mills and stuff that they contract with are FSC certified, and their own forests are FSC certified. And if you actually look into what that means, there's just no way that the FSC could even enforce a meaningful standard of sustainability. And so the way it operates, just a tiny international NGO that has a stamp, and it deputizes other independent organizations to give out that stamp. And the way it happens is, you know, if I'm a manufacturer, if I'm, you know, say one of the companies that makes the pieces of a folding chair for IKEA, I call up that company and I say, hey, I need you to come inspect my operation. It's planned ahead of time. The manufacturer pays the inspector themselves. And if they refuse to grant them the certification, they can just shop it around to a different group that's also deputized to give the stamp. And eventually someone will give it to them. And so, you know, it's one of these things where if you really look closely at the operation, you can see there's no meaningful enforcement mechanism. There would be no way to even have enough manpower to really assess, you know, what's tens of thousands of acres of forest land and, you know, millions of trees. And, you know, it's a really good, it's a very effective branding strategy. IKEA founded the FSC. It was one of the founding members 30 years ago. It's not really a meaningful environmental standard.
Well, okay. So the company, I mean, the NGO that they helped found is giving them a great environmental certification. So, I mean, wow, case closed, right, Alex?
yeah.
That's fascinating. And another part of your piece that was really interesting talks about how, like, there are some EU regulations, environmental regulations, but they skirt it entirely. Something like, you write, only 1% of illegal wood gets officially reported. How are they able to do such a thing? I mean, we'll get back to the violence in a second and the lawlessness that allows for this kind of exploitation, but what is the enforcement, and how are there really zero legal consequences for this?
It's one of these things that it's an expression as much of general corruption as anything else. And Romania, as many of these post-communist states after liberalization and privatization, it's a notoriously corrupt country. It's, you know, the sort of rankings that I think Transparency International is an annual ranking, and Romania is always last or tied for last in terms of corruption in the EU. The government did a survey on illegal logging just to get a sense of how bad the issue was. They thought it was, you know, it wasn't great. And the report came back that like 55% of the wood taken out of Romania every year is illegally logged. And the number was like so startling to them that they tried to suppress the report. And of course, they eventually got leaked. And, the large companies like IKEA who were out there were like, well, that's not ours is the 45%. That's fine. And it, of course, it's totally ridiculous, right? And as you mentioned, like only 1% of that illegal wood ever gets detained. There's a forest guard they chartered in 2015, but it only has 617 members. They don't work nights or weekends. You know, even if you catch a logger or a trucker in the midst of, you know, some illegal activity, you can't really detain them. Only the police can do that, and they have to call the forest guard. It just doesn't, there's just no meaningful enforcement mechanism. And like, it would just take so much visibility and manpower and those things that just aren't there. And so obviously this regime has set in, and lawlessness is basically the standard.
Right. And you experienced that firsthand. So, I mean, let's now dive into when you went to report on this story. It was quite dangerous, and you had some fears for your physical safety, given like the the story that you open up with, where there were two filmmakers or journalists and an environmental activist, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right. Both
beaten severely, at least one of them beaten unconscious. So you knew all of this going into this reporting, and you still went anyway. I mean, let's talk a little bit about your experience and what you saw with your own eyes and some of the threats that you face of just encounters with loggers that didn't know if you'd be like beaten up in the forest and no one would find you.
Yeah. So the research I did, I tagged along with a researcher who was compiling a report to the European Commission, so to the European Union, for its investigation into into Romania's basically inability to stem its illegal logging issues, especially in these protected old growth forests. And so he's someone who's done a lot of work in this. He takes a ton of precautions. And so, you know, we had a rental car, which couldn't be traced, you know, back to his house readily. We went largely on weekends when the logging site shouldn't have been active. We went in the afternoons when you would expect there to be less activity. We used a drone for a lot of the photo and video footage compiling so that we could maintain a safe distance. And even for in the piece, I refer to him by a fake name because he has to work undercover basically for his own safety. So we took a lot of precautions. And oftentimes would, you know, give our location to another person who was off site that, you know, if something did go terribly wrong, they would know in broad strokes where we were. So there were, you know, we did our best to be as safe as possible, but yeah, obviously there were still some moments that got pretty hairy.
I mean, talk a little bit about those moments if you don't mind.
Yeah, sure. There were a couple in particular. One, there was one site that we had identified from satellite imagery that looked like it had been logged in the last 12 months. It was an old growth forest, largely spruce, some beech as well. And on our way to that site, we actually encountered a placard that indicated there was logging going on. Legal logging had happened a couple months prior, but the certification had expired. But we could hear the sound of chainsaws. There were you know, recent truck tracks in the mud, and there was plenty of indication that this was ongoing. So we went up the logging road, and of course found a bunch of logs freshly cut. It was very clear what was going on. You could hear the trees falling in the forest, and there was a logger's hut with smoke coming out of the chimney. So we knew it was active. We tried to be as careful as we could and get some documentation of this. And while the drone was up in the air filming it, one of the loggers spotted us and started coming after us. And so, we had to make kind of a split decision. We couldn't get the drone down in time. There was just no way to do it. So, Andre, who I was with, jumped in the car, and I got in the passenger seat, and I flew the drone basically overhead. And he drove off until we could get to like a safer location where we could land the drone and then get out of there for good. And so, we got, you know, down to a lower elevation, got the drone. And then, of course, the logger who was following us basically caught up to us a second time. And we finally did get out of there, and we were fine. But it was one of those things where, it certainly had the potential to go awry. And it's not like we had phone service or anything like that. So, which actually, in some sense, was an asset because the logger couldn't call for backup or anything like that. But, there were some harrowing moments. We had another confrontation later on in an IKEA owned forest where we saw some illegal logging and ended up just confronting the logger who was engaged in it. And that too obviously could have escalated into something worse than it was, but thankfully it was, you know, never got too violent.
Yeah, thankfully. I mean, it based on, again, the stories that you tell, that sounds terrifying. I mean, do you have a sense of like once there is illegal logging, how the product is then sold with very little oversight or transparency to a major corporation like IKEA? I mean, is it just like the buyers are not asking questions? Is that really how it goes down?
Yeah, it's just hard to tell. You know, even if you have the best of intentions, which I don't think is the case necessarily, but you know, even if you were to grant the best of intentions, the way that the supply chain works here is that someone owns a forest, they sell a concession to a logging company. The company cuts as many trees as they're supposed to cut, and then probably a few more because they have to sell every log that they cut. And they sell those logs to a depot. The illegal logs and the legal logs at that point are all mixed up together. You have no idea which one is which. And then, you know, a furniture manufacturer will buy, you know, or a mill will buy the logs from the depot. They'll turn them into, you know, and process them into boards. And then a furniture manufacturer will buy the boards from the mill, and they'll make, you know, the three pieces of a folding chair that end up getting, you know, boxed up and packaged as the IKEA, you know, folding chair that's sold for $25 or whatever. It's just really hard to trace it. And, you know, you can, I mean, to get a sense of how rampant this is, you can really, you could follow, you know, a log and you know, these trucks are not hard to find full of, you know, full of illegal logs, and you can follow them to shipping yards that, you know, supply manufacturers that work with IKEA. There was an Al Jazeera news team that did this 2 years ago, and they found, you know, right away, the manufacturer called Chronospawn makes chipboard for IKEA. They saw illegal logs going into their yard. It was, you know, it's pretty open and shut, but in terms of on a large scale, and in terms of, you know, sussing out which, you know, which log is illegal and which one is savory, is basically, you know, it's basically impossible.
And then in terms of prosecution, that, I mean, there's been very, even with the beatings, like, it's one thing to attempt to crack down on the illegal logging in and of itself, right? Which, like, the systems clearly are not set up to allow for that at this current moment. But for beating somebody unconscious and bloodying them, one would think that there should be a criminal system that would deal with that adequately. Like, these cases don't even seem to be brought, I mean, seem to be. You write about how these cases aren't even really brought to trial. What's your understanding of, like, some of the corruption that's clearly involved in there, in Romania?
Yeah, there are a couple of cases. There was one, this environmentalist named Gabby Pond, who started an NGO called... oh God, the name escapes me now. But anyways, he's an environmentalist in Romania. He was beaten in an attack in 2015. The entire attack was caught on camera. He was traveling, I think, with a videographer, and the whole thing was caught on film. I met up with him in Bucharest while I was there, and he was still delivering documents as proof of the damage that he had sustained from that attack to the prosecutor, which still hadn't filed charges. And, you know, this was almost 7 years later at that point. And he had since gone into hiding, you know, for fear of his own life, and had left Romania entirely, actually, at a certain point. And that's pretty standard. There was the murder that I mentioned at the beginning of this, our conversation. Initially, I thought I'd be able to talk to his family. What I ended up hearing was that the family had been paid off. Basically, their silence had been effectively purchased. There's, you know, a widow, a wife with three children. It wasn't worth it for her to go through the process of a prosecution, even though it could have been fairly straightforward. They just took a settlement from I'm not sure who and wouldn't talk. So, yeah, these things don't go to trial, even with open and shut video evidence and willing victims of the attacks. They still are basically, those attacks basically are done with impunity.
And in terms of, again, just going back to IKEA's complicity in all of this, I was not aware until reading your piece about how much explosive growth the furniture industry is likely to experience in the next few years. This means that likely these practices are going to get even more robust and thus shadier, probably, unless my second and final question will be if IKEA even responded to your piece. But first, I want to talk about the growth of the furniture industry and the role that plays in what you saw and what you reported on.
Sure. Yeah. I looked at a market research report that had, I think, indicated that the fast furniture industry would grow from, like, it was supposed to almost double between 2020 and 2025, I think, was the forecast. So obviously it's a huge growth sector. It's not just IKEA now. Obviously it's Wayfair, and, you know, there's distributors on Amazon like Zynus. And I think it's an interesting sector because it's also an expression of, you know, rising housing prices and cost of living. And, you know, if you are paying all your money on rent, you can't spend a bunch of money on furniture that you're going to have for a long time. You get the cheapest furniture you can possibly get and expect to throw it away in 12 months or less.
I know. And I've experienced that myself. Cheap furniture does not pay off.
Yeah. I mean, me as well, certainly. But it's kind of an interesting, you know, it's the sort of flip side of some of these larger sort of economic trends that we know to be the case is that, yeah, people would once buy furniture and assume they were going to have it for many years, if not decades. It was like a permanent fixture of your life. And now, because of the way the housing market is, that just isn't a decision that especially young people make. And, you know, IKEA is certainly like a millennial consumable brand in a lot of ways. And it's the convenience of flat pack furniture has been very alluring. And obviously it's a massive growth market now.
So lastly, your piece, it came out around 3 weeks ago, something like that. Has there been a response by IKEA? I mean, have you seen any like ripples? Because it's nuts. Again, I really encourage everybody to check it out in the New Republic.
Thanks. I ran a bunch of questions by them for a comment while I was doing the reporting. They didn't respond initially. I kind of pestered them for a while and got the sort of like boilerplate answer that, you know, they are not involved with old growth forests, period, under any circumstance. Which, you know, of course is ridiculous. I went there and saw it. I stood in the midst of it. So, you know, it's just beyond that, there wasn't much they didn't offer much. I think, you know, I was wondering if there'd be a response after the piece published. There hasn't been. IKEA did just mention that they're going to be exiting, the Russian market entirely, both in terms of selling and sourcing, wood, which is actually going to put, I think we'll put more pressure on Romania just because, you know, that's where their supply chain is located. As I said before, 60% of their wood comes from Eastern Europe and Russia. So, it's going to be, continue to be a problem. I think that's probably part of the reason they were, you know, hesitant to respond because ultimately, you know, that's the model and they're not going to change that just because of a little bad publicity. So, that's pretty much all they offered me.
Well, Alex Salmon of the American Prospect, you can read his work there and then also this piece in the New Republic, as I mentioned. Thank you so much for your time today, Alex. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much. Nice talking to you.
Nice talking to you, too. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, come back, wrap up the first hour of the program.
We'll be right back.
We are back. And before we head into the fun half, I wanted to highlight this from Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds' response to Biden's State of the Union address. Now, this bizarre ritual of everybody, you know, the Republican response to the State of the Union. I mean, I appreciate the progressive response, the Working Family Party's response that Rashida Tlaib engaged in. I'm down for that. But like, everybody has to have a separate response. Nobody really cares. I don't understand why this has become an annual thing. But regardless, I wanted to highlight what she says here because it shows why Biden's gratuitous and needless moment when he decided to say, let's fund the police more. I mean, this is what he believes. That's the reality. But he went out of his way to crap all over defund and the activists that had supported it. And yet, the Republicans are still going to claim that Democrats like Biden support defunding the police. Who could have seen this coming?
That's what the Biden administration has been pushing for over the last year. And that's all part of Build Back Better. Thankfully, the president's agenda didn't pass because even members of his own party said enough is enough. Well, the American people share that view. Enough is enough. And it's not just with D.C. spending.
The Biden administration
Americans
has
are
been
tired of a political class
year.
Trying to and that's remake this country into a place but where an elite view tell everyone else what they can and cannot say, what they can and cannot believe.
Is enough.
They're tired of people pretending.
The American people share that view.
Enough is enough. And it's not just with D.C. spending.
The Biden administration
Americans
has
are
been
tired
for
of a political class
year,
sit down, be silent, and let government control their kids' education and future.
Everyone else, what they can and cannot say,
what they can and cannot believe
is enough.
They're tired of people pretending.
American people share that view.
Enough is enough. And it's not just with D.C. spending.
The Biden administration
Americans
has
are
been
tired
for
of a political
over the last
class
year,
sit
trying
down,
to
be silent, country and let government control their kids' education and future.
Everyone else,
what they can and cannot say, what they can and cannot believe
is enough.
They're tired of people pretending.
The American people share that view.
Enough is enough. And it's not just with D.C.
the
spending.
Biden administration
Americans
has
are
been
tired of a political class
year,
sit down, be silent,
country
and let government control their kids' education and future.
Everyone else,
what they can and cannot say, what they can and cannot believe
is enough.
They're tired.
What happened? Okay. All right. So, well, for YouTube, we'll edit it in post, but she criticizes Biden saying that Democrats want to defund the police. The point being, Biden went out of his way to kick the left, say, and give a gift to, I'm sure, the moderate, centrist, whatever, corporatist Democrats that felt that defund is going to be an issue for us in the elections in the fall. Say they're in purple districts, they're convinced that being tagged with defunding the police is going to hurt them. Now, I'm not convinced that that's the case. I think that often the reason that lawmakers or Democrats lose is because they're not aggressive enough. And they don't get enough done. I mean, there is a sense that's accurate in the country that Biden has not adequately done enough for the American people. And that's because Build Back Better has failed. And that is the issue. Acting and being active and doing things and delivering on your promises, that is the thing that actually helps do we have somebody in here? Okay. All right, we got to mute him. That helps Democrats electorally. So Biden really was, I think, frankly, it was a completely useless exercise, because you add stigma to defund the police. And when you add stigma to it, you're still getting tagged with supporting defund the police. So needlessly kicking the left, as opposed to getting out ahead of it and saying, this is what defund activists are talking about, or here's something, just don't mention it in your speech. All right, folks. Sorry again for any technical difficulties. We're working with it right now. We now have Matt and Brandon, but we got to go into a quick break really briefly. Be right back. We are back. Apologies again for some of the tech issues. We're still figuring that out. But Binder and Brandon are here. Hello, guys.
B&B, we're back again.
B&B,
what's up, fam?
How are you?
I'm okay. I'm all right. We're figuring some stuff out. What's happening over on Doomed and on Scam Economy, Binder?
Well, there's quite a lot actually to mention. First off, I want to say that it was quite the experience watching the show right before I came on, and seeing that Emma loop with that GOP governor. It was like some sort of remix. Maybe who puts together the second half song, whoever does that one, maybe they could create something cool with that. But anyway, tonight on Scam Economy, 9 p.m. Eastern time at youtube.com/Matt Binder, and then as a podcast at scameconomy.com. I will be talking with Wilfred Chen. He is a freelance writer who basically wrote this great piece about his recent experience visiting a physical NFT vending machine in the financial district. It is actually more – he gives us, we could all live vicariously through him as he walks us through the process, but his experience is very funny. And we talk about basically how, you know, this world loops in with, you know, real life Manhattan real estate and the metaverse and a whole bunch of things. It's a really great conversation. Definitely tune in tonight. It'll be live 9 p.m. Eastern time. And also on Doomed, late last week, I had on my show, a Russian socialist writer, Yegor Kotkin, and I apologize to him if I messed up his name like I did 100 times while I was talking to him. But he gave a really great perspective as someone born and raised in Russia, lives in Moscow. Basically, what Putin's thinking is on what's going on and what we're sort of missing on the Ukraine and Russia situation in America or the West in general. And also really educated me on just how much the U.S. right-wing movement, like American conservatism, has influenced really just Russian culture and politics in general. It was really a fascinating look. You know, anyone who thinks it's the other way around where, you know, Putin has some sort of influence over the U.S., right, I think would be extremely surprised to hear it's the other way around.
Wow. All right. Well, check that out. And Brandon, what's happening over on the discourse?
We weren't able to record this weekend due to my birthday, even though I promised you all that we were. Hell yeah. Getting older. I share a birthday with W.E.B. Du Bois. So, you know, a lot of people are saying that I'm the W.E.B. Du Bois of the modern generation. I don't know who's saying that, but I've been assured a lot of them are saying it. But we should have an episode recapping the past two.
Many
people. I'm sorry. Oh, okay. I count Emma amongst those many people now.
Yes.
Saying that very thing. But yeah, no, we'll have an episode for those who are waiting with bated breath coming out next week or this weekend, hopefully, after we convene the roundtable.
Okay, well, excellent. We are going to attempt some clips in the fun half.